About a year ago, my wife and I became quite concerned one evening as we were sitting in the living room. We'd put the kids to bed. It was about 10 o'clock at night when suddenly we heard a wheezing sound coming from my 2-year-old son's bedroom. I opened the door and walked up to his crib to get a better look at what was going on, and sure enough, it appeared that Timmy was struggling to breathe. And so I told Megan, we gotta take him to the emergency room. And she agreed. So we called Megan's mom, who thankfully lives 2 streets over from us. She said she'd be there right away to watch the girls while we were gone. Megan and I quickly climbed in the van, buckled Timmy up, and we took off for the emergency room. And every so often, we would look back and see how he was doing. And he didn't look good. And I will admit to you that on the way to the emergency room, I may have exceeded the speed limit. I admit to you that I may have even gone through several red lights. I did things considered by the cities of Riverview and Trenton and Woodhaven to be unlawful. The leadership of these cities had instituted traffic laws, and I had broken them. Now, suppose, this didn't happen, thankfully, but suppose I had been pulled over by a police officer, and he realized that this had been an emergency. How do you think he would have responded? Would he have taken a look at my struggling son, and would he have said, I'm sorry, I can't let you go until you pay this ticket? Would he say, you broke the law, you have to pay the fine? What would he say? What would he do? He would recognize that in this moment, there was a greater law. A law that supersedes the normal man-made traffic laws that he was called to enforce. And it's a law of protecting and preserving my son's life. So you could say the right thing for that officer to do in that moment would not be to burden us by unmercifully enforcing a man-made law. The right thing, the best thing would be for that police officer to do whatever he could to lift us up in the midst of our struggle by helping us get to the ER as safely and as quickly as possible. As we turn to Luke 14 this morning, we come upon a scenario in the ministry of Jesus somewhat similar to the one I just described. So I'll give you a moment to turn there if you haven't turned there already, but Luke chapter 14, I want you to follow along with me as I begin in verse 1. It says, now it happened, and we read this earlier, as Jesus, went into the house of one of the rulers of the Pharisees to eat bread on the Sabbath, that they watched him closely, and behold, there was a certain man before him who had dropsy. And Jesus, answering, spoke to the lawyers and Pharisees, saying, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? Now, dropsy is not a very familiar word probably to most of you, but another word might be, and that's the word edema, or edema, how you pronounce it. And some of you have even experienced that in your life. This is the buildup of fluid in the body's tissues. It's the swelling of limbs. And you can develop this buildup of fluid in a variety of ways. It might simply be from being on your feet too much. So if you work in a restaurant business or you're on your feet there as part of your work, maybe you've experienced this kind of swelling. But it also can result from something as serious as congestive heart failure or some kind of disease of the kidney or the liver. We don't know what the underlying condition was that caused the buildup of fluid in this man's appendages. We don't know if it was minor or if it was major. Perhaps it may have been an issue that the man could have put off a day or two before bringing it to the attention of Jesus. But here's this man with his dropsy, with his edema, coming to the dinner table where Jesus was sitting for healing on the Sabbath. Now, just to make sure, you might think about this man going into the dinner room and saying, why is he here? In our culture, if a random man walked into your dining room, you might be alarmed. You have to understand that it wasn't unusual in that culture for this man to be here. In fact, whenever religious leaders and teachers got together for a meal, it often was made a public event. People could look through the windows, they could come into the room, they could sit around and glean from these religious leaders and teachers and learn something about God and about the law of God, and they could glean truth from these wise men. But these Pharisees were probably very familiar with Jesus' past Sabbath episodes, and there's been several of them in the Gospel of Luke. So when they see this man with swollen limbs come into the room and make a beeline for Jesus, they stop whatever they do and they fix their eyes on Jesus. Because what's going through their mind? They're thinking, it's a Sabbath. And Jesus has always done things unethical or unorthodox on the Sabbath. What's he going to do here? Will Jesus heal this man on the Sabbath? Will Jesus provide them something with which they could bring before a judge and accuse Jesus by? Last Sunday, we did see that there were some Pharisees, there were some Jewish leaders who were sympathetic to Jesus, even some who we found out to be disciples of Jesus Christ, like Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea. But the majority of the religious leaders in Jesus' day were always looking for an excuse to bring Jesus to court. And if you may recall from Luke chapter 11, and in fact you can turn there, it's just a page or two away. Luke chapter 11, verse 53, you see what I mean. It says there, Luke 11, verse 53, and this is after Jesus just blasts the Pharisees, he blasts the scribes, the lawyers, for their hypocritical lifestyle. So as he said these things to them, it says in verse 53, the scribes and the Pharisees began to assail him vehemently and cross-examine him about many things, lying in wait for him, seeking to catch him in something he might say that they might accuse him. So this is what these guys are thinking. Can we catch him this time? What can we accuse him of? If he heals this man, maybe we can turn that to our favor and get rid of this guy. So as we look in Luke 14, we see that they're at it again. They're holding their collective breath. They're waiting to see what Jesus would do. And then Jesus derails everything with a very difficult question. Is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? According to Jewish Sabbath tradition, it was generally considered to be unlawful to perform any kind of medical work on the Sabbath, unless a person's life was in jeopardy. As we discussed a number of weeks ago, you won't find anything about healing on the Sabbath day in the law that God gave to Moses there on Mount Sinai. The main significant thing you see is no working on the Sabbath. That day is set apart unto the Lord. You are to do no work on it. But there's very little specification, very little specific details given as to what that work would look like. It should be self-explanatory. No work. You know what work is. It's going and weeding the garden. It's going and washing your clothes. I mean, this is the kind of work that comes to mind when you think work. These religious leaders did value God's law. In fact, they valued it so much, they didn't want anyone to even get close to breaking it. And so what they did, we often call that they hedged God's law with other rules. If you don't want someone to fall off a cliff, what do? I mean, you can tell them, don't go by the cliff. But you can also take a further step and say, we're going to put a fence up so that he doesn't go past the cliff. And that's kind of what they were doing here. And maybe it was out of pure motives, might have been impure motives. But they made additional lists of Sabbath do's and don'ts to make sure that God's people didn't break God's law. The problem was they also elevated that list of do's and don'ts to be essentially equal with God's law. So any healing in this case performed for people with non-life-threatening health issues would have probably been considered off-limits. But notice how the Pharisees respond to Jesus' question in verse 4. What do they say? They don't say anything, do they? It says they kept silence. I wonder why. We don't know what's going through their minds, but they probably, we could probably speculate they didn't actually have a good answer. That's usually when you're silent, right? I don't know what to say. After all, how could they tell if this man with dropsy only had moments to live or decades to live? It could have been either or. I don't know. But in answer to their silence, Jesus does what we have come to expect him to do. What does he do? He takes this man with his swollen appendages and he heals him. He sends him away, and then Jesus narrows in on the main point that we'll be looking at this morning. He begins by asking these lawyers, these scribes, these Pharisees, the most leading question yet. Which of you, having a donkey or an ox that has fallen into a pit, will not immediately pull him out on the Sabbath day? It's interesting, the oldest Greek manuscripts we have actually read, which of you having a son or an ox that has fallen into a pit, which of you will not immediately pull him out on the Sabbath day? I mean, that's even more significant if that were the case. But you have to understand, this is a rhetorical question that Jesus is asking here. He intends that there should be an obvious answer to this question, doesn't he? Which of you will not immediately pull him out on the Sabbath day? What should be the obvious answer? Which of you would do this? All of you would do this. Any of you would do this. That's a no-duh. Even if it wasn't a life-threatening situation. I mean, if my son fell in a hole in the ground, I wouldn't care what day it was, I'd spring to action, wouldn't I? And any of you fathers or mothers would do the same. You wouldn't say, well, it's the Sabbath. I don't do that kind of thing on the Sabbath. Son, you're just going to have to wait there until tomorrow. I don't think so. In fact, that would be something that you'd probably get thrown in jail for. Because there's a law that supersedes the traditions of the elders, the traditions of the Jewish leaders in this case. And verse 6 reveals to us that this question must have jarred the religious leaders. And you see this reoccurring theme in this passage. What does it say? They could not answer him regarding these things. I think this is very telling because it leaves us wondering, I don't know, would these religious leaders immediately have pulled out their sons or their ox out of a pit on the Sabbath? Maybe not. Maybe. But I believe the point Jesus is making is pretty clear. He's already revealed to them his answer by healing the man with dropsy. Which of you, having a son or an ox or a donkey or an ox that has fallen into a pit, will not immediately pull him out on the Sabbath day? What's Jesus' answer? I would. I've shown you that I would. I would lift someone out who has fallen. I would pull someone out of a pit and lift him to higher ground because it's my nature to do that. And friends, as we look at our text today, as we continue studying God's word this morning, and as we see on the text behind me, it is the nature of God to exalt people. but only a certain kind of person. It is God's nature as a father to lift up his child from a lowly place to an exalted place. So with this question, Jesus turns the spotlight on the scribes and Pharisees themselves and brings us into the main meat of what we're looking at this morning. Even though Jesus is surrounded by men who are his enemies, right? You have to take this into consideration. These are his enemies. They're always after him. But Jesus, in love, loves them enough to give them the truth. Right? Isn't that what love does? It speaks the truth. It doesn't try to get buddy-buddy with someone who's living in sin. It speaks the truth into their life of sin. This morning, there are two qualities that we see Jesus pointing out to these men that will result in God lifting up a person. Certainly, you look throughout Scripture, there are many more qualities we could highlight, but there are two that Jesus highlights for this group of people, these Pharisees, these scribes. At this moment, Jesus focuses on two qualities that must exist in a person that God will exalt. I'm going to give you them right now, and we'll unfold them. First of all, humility. And secondly, sacrifice. Humility and sacrifice must be present in the life of someone God exalts. Let's see what Jesus says about the first of these two qualities, humility, beginning in verse 7. It says in verse 7, "So he told a parable to those who were invited when he noted how they chose the best places, saying to them, 'When you are invited by anyone to a wedding feast, do not sit down in the best place, lest someone more honorable than you be invited by him. And he who invited you and him come and say to you, "Give place to this man." And then you begin with shame to take the lowest place. But when you are invited, go and sit down in the lowest place, so that when he who invited you comes, he may say to you, 'Friend, go up higher.' Then you will have glory in the presence of those who sit at the table with you." Now, one word should jump out at you here at the very beginning. It's the word parable. What does the word parable remind us to be looking for? Right, a parable isn't just a story. It's a particular kind of story, isn't it? Some would describe it as an earthly story with a heavenly meaning, or an earthly story with a kingdom meaning. In other words, there is something that Jesus wishes to communicate to us from this story that we need to keep in mind as we think about the life to come. We are intended by the Lord to learn from this earthly illustration a significant truth about the connection between life in this world and life in the kingdom of God. There's a connection here that we need to make. So in this parable, Jesus is warning the scribes and the Pharisees who have been invited, right? These are guests here at the meal. He is warning these scribes and Pharisees about the kind of mindset and practice that pursues exaltation in this life. You understand about the Pharisees by now, probably, that the Pharisees loved the glory and the praise of men. In fact, this desire for man's glory is something that Jesus condemns the Pharisees for back in Luke 11. There he says in verse 43, "Woe to you Pharisees! For you love the best seats in the synagogues and greetings in the marketplaces." So Jesus is going after a root issue here for the scribes and Pharisees with this parable. The Pharisees sought seats of honor. The Pharisees went after the glory of men. The Pharisees were obsessed with how people perceived them and what people thought about them because they were obsessed about themselves. And with this parable, Jesus is pointing out that the Pharisees' way of self-glory is completely opposite the way of God. They were pursuing exaltation and praise in this life. They were desiring glory and honor in this life. And the root cause behind these things was their exalting of themselves in their own thinking. My friends, this bent, this tendency toward lifting up of self is something that is alive in every one of us today. I don't think any of us here would deny that there exists in each one of us a tendency to see ourselves as the greatest and the best in at least some area of our life. Maybe not every area, because we're honest to some extent. But maybe in some areas, this is our way of thinking. Maybe you're here today and you tend to see yourself as the best employee at your business. Maybe you see yourself as the best kind of parent or grandparent. Maybe you tend to see yourself as the best kind of spouse. Maybe you see yourself as being the best worker or the best servant. And I think we know the problem isn't doing our best in something. That's not what Jesus is confronting here. In fact, doing our best in circumstances is actually biblical. We see that in Ecclesiastes chapter 9. It says, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. Doing the best you can do at something or being the best that you can be isn't the problem that Jesus is pointing out here. The problem is when we exalt ourselves in our thinking and our demeanor and in our minds, and we declare ourselves to be the best. Friends, it's this kind of mindset that leads a person to assume that they deserve the best. And you hear that a lot in our day. I deserve this. Or, you deserve that. That's what the Pharisees felt. They felt entitled to the best seats. They felt themselves to be deserving of recognition. But what does Jesus say will be the result in the life to come for everyone who exalts himself or herself in this life? It says here, he will be humbled. She will be brought down. In the life to come, the one who has lived this life exalting himself will be torn off the pedestal on which he has placed himself, and he will be humiliated. Because the kind of person that is exalted in the presence of God isn't someone who exalts himself. It's someone whom God chooses to exalt. So if the kind of person who exalts himself in this life will be humiliated by God in the life to come, what kind of person will God exalt in the life to come? And we see it here in our text today that God will exalt the person who humbles himself in this life. In verse 10 of Jesus' parable, this is the person who of his own accord chooses the lowest place of honor at the wedding feast. Right, this is someone with a mindset who is honored just to be there. This is the kind of person who knows that he has done nothing to deserve the privilege of being invited to this wonderful event. He views himself to be unworthy of any honor the host might bestow on him. He takes the lowest seat, right? That might be the floor, for all we know. The reality is, we are all unworthy and undeserving of any good thing the Lord might give to us. Not one of us deserves a nice family. Not one of us deserves a good-paying job. Not one of us deserves a nice house or a nice car or a nice vacation or a beautiful spouse or a handsome husband. The only thing that every single person in this room truly deserves, including myself, is death and hell for all eternity. Ephesians 2:3 says that we all once conducted ourselves in the lust, the sinful desires of our flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and of the mind, and were by nature children of wrath. People deserving God's wrath. Romans 6:23 says the wages or the payment owed to us because of our sin is death. We deserve God's wrath to be poured out on us. We deserve the wages of death for our sin against a righteous, holy God. We deserve an eternity of being separated from God in the lake of fire. That is what God Himself declares in His Word, the Bible, to be what we deserve. And we must come to grips with the reality of what God says we deserve, and we must humble ourselves and agree with Him. We must come to view ourselves as vile, wretched sinners who deserve no place in God's eternal kingdom. We must view ourselves as completely helpless to do anything to change our sinful condition. We must view ourselves as completely dependent on His mercy and on His grace to lift us up from the filth and the wickedness of our sin, and recognize that God alone can save us, which He does through faith in His Son, Jesus Christ. My friend, that is the kind of humility that God is looking for. That is the kind of humility that pleases God. It's a person who demonstrates that kind of humility who will find himself exalted by God in the life to come. Whoever exalts himself will be humbled. And he who humbles himself will be exalted. Humility. Living in a way that keeps in full focus what we truly deserve. Yet thankful to God for His mercy and grace by pouring out what we deserved on His Son Jesus instead. Continuing on to verse 12, we see the second quality that must exist in a person that God will exalt, and that is sacrifice. Verse 12, it says, He also said to him who invited him, all right, so changing the person that he's speaking to, not the ones who are invited now, but to the one who invited. He says to him, when you give a dinner or a supper, do not ask your friends, your neighbors, your relatives, or rich neighbors, lest they also invite you back and you be repaid. Now we have to just mention something. He's not saying that it's wrong to do that. I have family over to my house. My father-in-law comes over and he eats food with us. He's not saying don't have a meal with your family. But he's getting at something here. He says in verse 13, when you give a feast, invite the poor, the maimed, the lame, the blind. And it has to do with this idea of sacrifice. Now, you might think you are doing something sacrificial by inviting friends and family and relatives and rich neighbors to dinner, right? Maybe at work you get together with people, and it's kind of funny. I get together with a few pastors once a month, and one pastor is always insisting on buying my meal. And sometimes we have this fun little, okay, I'll steal it this week. But at the end of the day, you all can afford to pay for it. We might think that by providing a meal for friends or doing a favor for a family member or a rich neighbor might categorize you as a giving person in the sight of others and in the sight of God. But is that the case if they return the favor at a later point? Is it really sacrifice if it doesn't actually cost you something? If everyone's even at the end of the day, has it cost you anything? Is it really sacrifice? There's no spiritual benefit in living an I scratch your back, you scratch my back kind of lifestyle. If people are able to pay you back in some way, there's no sacrifice to that. It's just a trading of resources. But the kind of sacrifice that Jesus is talking about here, and it's the kind of sacrifice that God delights in, is doing something for someone that truly costs you because you're doing it for someone who is unable to pay it back. This would be, for example, like meeting an unexpected financial need of someone who's on a fixed income. This would be like helping someone with a project who is physically unable to do it on their own. This is focusing your time and your resources and your efforts on those who will not be able to return the favor. Notice how Jesus concludes in verse 14. He says, verse 13, when you give a feast, invite the poor, the maimed, the lame, the blind, and you will be blessed because they cannot repay you. Where does the true blessing come? It's not in this life. You're not looking for some kind of applause from men in this life. What are you looking forward to? You're looking to receiving something from the hand of God Himself. Right? You are giving out in this life, knowing that in the life to come, that's when it will be repaid. You shall be repaid at the resurrection of the just. The person who humbles himself in this life, God will exalt in the life to come. The person who sacrificially gives in this life, God will repay in the life to come. Because a person who is truly humble and truly sacrificial is going to be a person who has seen that Jesus Christ is worth it. Jesus Christ is worth it. He is worth the sacrifice that you give in this life. He is worth the self-humbling of yourself when everyone else is stepping all over you. He's worth it. While everyone else is struggling his way up the corporate ladder to make a name for himself, the follower of Jesus recognizes that he is nobody apart from Jesus. Jesus alone is worthy. While everyone else is tearing down others around them, thinking that they deserve to be number one, the follower of Jesus recognizes that he's a big zero because of his sin. And only Jesus is deserving of number one in his life. Well, everyone is preoccupied with being even with each other, making sure that we don't owe anyone and nobody owes us. The follower of Jesus looks to love and meet the needs of those who cannot repay you. After all, Jesus gave his life when you were dead in trespasses and sins. So my friend, as you live this life following Jesus, I pray that today you've been reminded of what we truly deserve. And that only Jesus was able to pay that debt in your place. And I hope that shapes how you interact with people in this life. I hope that shapes the decisions that you make in this life. I hope that realizing what we truly deserve will cause us to look at ourselves with humility and say, I don't deserve anything. All I have, I am who I am by the grace of God. So as you prepare yourself for this week, right, you're going to go from this place, you're going to go into the beginning of a new week. As you prepare for yourself for this new week, ask yourself, how can I walk humbly before God? Can I humbly do, for example, that task at work which everyone else hates to do? Can I humbly love my spouse by being the first person to admit how I was wrong in the most recent argument that we had? Can I humbly drive my car down the freeway knowing I deserve hell far more than I deserve the right of way? And secondly, how can I give sacrificially this week? How can I meaningfully bless others who I know will not be able to pay me back? Are there needy people in this church or even in my community who I can sacrificially bless now with material things and leave the matter of repayment with the Lord in eternity? Humility and sacrifice. May we trust our Lord to teach us to live humbly and sacrificially for His sake, starting today. Let's pray.